huge news, years in the making, my brand new book that my publishers refuse to publish, Money Matrix. Beat the money system and build generational wealth. Understand the three main ways that the banks productize you and make money from you. You'll be able to turn that system against itself, build generational wealth and multiple streams of recurring income. It's all at moneymatrix.cash. And if you're quick, the first few hundred registrants and buyers will receive many special bonuses from me. The brand new Moneymaker Summit 3-day special event. Meet me at a champagne reception. Meet me at a multi-millionaire networking dinner. Go now, moneymatrix.cash. This is huge.
Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
It means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means shaking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up and awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive, but also profitable.
When you use your own reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hi, it's Rob Moore here, and welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. This episode's a little different. It's actually a live talk, so you're going to be cut in to a Q&A, an AMA, an Ask Me Anything session on the subject of money. So I did a mini tour to celebrate the launch of my book, Money, around central London, St Pancras, Mayfair, Knightsbridge, and people came from all over the country to ask me their specific question on money, finance, how to scale their business, how to raise money, how to do joint ventures. I was asked a lot about the early days of starting up my companies. I think you'll really enjoy it. It is a bit different. It's probably quite noisy, so bear with it. And let's go now live to talking about money.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Take a seat. Take a seat. So I have nothing to say, in that I have no PowerPoints, so I'm all yours. Who wants to start and fire out the first question about money for me to answer?
Jackie says, you did a lot of research into multimillionaires and billionaires for your new book, Money. What are key and common traits and their attitude towards money?
Some of the commonalities of millionaires and billionaires are, number one, write this down, is they offer a product or service that vast numbers of people want and need. James Dyson, Steve Jobs, Richard Branson, Sam Walton. It's virtually proportioned in that the more people they serve, the more money they make. Hans Rausing, one of the richest billionaires in the whole world. The family of Rausing, their company is Tetra Pak. So what they did was solved the problem of birds pecking at silver milk bottle tops and ring pools being chucked on the floor. But of course, there's hundreds of billions of units that have been sold. The post-it note, 3M. I actually researched, it's in the new book, Money, the amount of post-it notes that are sold a year, I can't even remember, but it's hundreds of billions. So you can serve someone by selling them a packet of post-it notes, or you can serve someone by alleviating them from a disease or whatever. So it's not what it is. Is it valuable to society? So they serve vast numbers of people, number one. Now, this isn't just the billionaires and millionaires I know or the billionaires that I've studied. This is the billionaires over history. So the second thing is they believed it was a divine right in the past, you know, when people were more religious than they are now, because some many are, but it was a divine, almost God-given right for them to have opulence in their life. And I don't know any billionaires who feel that it's wrong to be surrounded by opulence. There's, of course, what's the chap's name? Chuck, who's a billionaire, and he's giving it all away now. But, you know, he still would have gone on private jets here and there, and he still would have lived an opulent life before he had his plan to give it away. You know, people sometimes cite to me, well, Warren Buffett's different because he lives a frugal life. We knew him. We nearly employed him for the 2010 Super Conference. And he wanted a private jet to be chartered by us and five of his entourage to come. So you can't tell me he didn't like a bit of opulence. you know, just other people paying for it. So this is where a lot of people fall short. Because if you're working class or if you're brought up with parents who worked hard and didn't really have a lot of money, and you've been conditioned by society that making money is hard, earning money is hard, and it's bad to show off your wealth, you won't surround yourself with opulence. Now, if you make enough money, some of it will stick to you. So this is what they've believed through, you know, the kings, the warriors. You know, when they used to go and raid villages and steal all the treasure, they believed they were destined for vast wealth. And every millionaire or billionaire that I know, in their core, they know they deserve what they have. And so if you keep giving it away, because there are plenty of people I know, I was just talking to someone in the bar earlier, who said, you know, that they just seem to, they can make money, but they keep giving it away. So the first thing I'd like to say about that is, if you have that problem, you can give your money to me, because I'm okay with accepting it. I've got no problem with accepting money. But why do people give money away if they make a lot of it? One, and you want to write this down, guilt. Much charity is alleviating your own guilt. You know, look at the adverts that they put on TV. What are they doing? Stoking your guilt. Now, if you've got unresolved issues in your past, which most of us have, and you know, not everyone has a problem with giving money away, so this might not be relevant to you, but it might be. But if you keep less than you earn, you have a problem. Keep more than you earn. Yeah, you get what I mean. Then you have a problem with giving too much away. So often, I've known quite a lot of people like this who've made millions and they're left with nothing because they don't feel they're deserving of opulence. So they won't buy opulent material items because they don't want to be judged and they still have all this pain, fear, guilt, shame. And each time money comes in, they go, give it away, spend it away, give it away, often on non-material things so they can't be judged by society. Waste it, squander it. And then what happens is they get desperate. So then they have to reduce their morals and values to go and earn more, because that's what human beings do when you're desperate. You'd do anything to survive, to eat, to earn if you're skint. So that's when you reduce your morals, because when you do that, society outs you. So the biggest gift you can give to yourself is have opulence around you to the point where you don't have to lower your morals and values. So when you sell and when you inspire, your morals and values are high, people can feel that and then they give you money. Of course, the other side of that is greed. Now, if someone is overly greedy and hoards money, society dries up their flow. Now, the law of conservation of energy states that energy is never created or destroyed, it's simply transferred in the universe. And so money is. You know, people think, oh, well, bullshit, Rob, quantitative easing. You know, like printing money creates it out of nothing. It doesn't. It's an idea, because you get money by offering a service to someone that they value equally or more than the money they give you. So both too much giving away and too much hoarding in, society will take your money away from you or take your opportunities to make more money. So the next thing then is managing money, you know, the tactical ability to manage money. Some people just don't know what they earn and don't know what they spend. And one of my mentors said to me, Rob, you'll never get more money until you learn to manage what you've already got. And there are loads of stories, many of them are in my book, about people who won the lottery and what happened to nearly all of them 2 years later. They were less wealthy than when they started with nothing. If someone squanders all their money they have down the pub and you give them more money, what do? They drink more and they buy more people more drinks. There were these two lottery winners in Peterborough, and for about 2 years they were going around town all the time buying everyone in the pub drinks. Everybody. They bought these quad bikes and were razzing them around town. This is why my vision is for global financial freedom. I'm just in the legal process of setting up my foundation because I want to change at the core in schools, at the heart of where we teach people. I want to change that we need better education around money. It's not someone's fault if they don't know how to manage money if they've never been taught. You know, because some people say, oh, you know, rich people are winners and poor people are losers. Oh, I think that's bollocks. That's too binary. There are a lot of people who don't have a lot of money because they've not been taught how to make money and they've not been given the resources or the upbringing or even the clean water to be able to learn these ways. Hence why I wrote the book called Money. So you were asking for commonalities. So virtually every millionaire and billionaire I've met and I've studied has been able to inspire the masses. Now, yeah, there are some that do it by control. But mostly, and I'm not talking about inherited wealth either, because, you know, if you look at sort of Duke of Westminster family, you know, or the Illuminati, or we're controlled by a few families, you know, inherited wealth through generations, that's different. You can't really compare that. Self-made wealth. You know, look, Steve Jobs became a great speaker. He could inspire people. Steve Jobs could get someone working at Apple to believe that they could do something that they never believed they could. You know, and Warren Buffett, people, they do like a conference every year and thousands of people go to see Warren Buffett speak. You know, often the best presidents are people who are either the best speakers or have the most followers. So basically Donald Trump used Twitter to, you know, pretty bigger Twitter fan base, better use of Twitter. And by the way, I'm totally not political, so I'm not going to go there and talk about that. But so inspiring, influencing vast numbers of people.
Hitesh says, what is your view about digital currencies, for example, Bitcoin?
My view is this is going to become more and more relevant as technology exponentially speeds up. Now, there was someone called Gordon Moore, who was one of the founders of Fairchild Semiconductor, which was the original Silicon Valley company before Silicon Valley was a thing. And Gordon Moore worked out that the processing power of a computer would double in a given number of time. It was either 2 or 3 years. So technology has exponentially sped up. Now, how is this relevant to money? The faster money moves, the easier it is to make. Money loves speed and money hates friction. So imagine you go on a website, Amazon, to buy something and the checkout page takes 30 seconds to load. You're gone. You're not buying it. Now, centuries ago, money only moved at the speed of the animal that the human being was riding or delivering the message or the money on. And then what happened was steel, which created rail, dramatically increased the speed. And then telecommunications and microwaves dramatically increased the speed. And then fiber optics and light dramatically increased the speed. So digital currencies are essentially leveraging fiber optics, i.e. the speed of light, to exchange money. So that is where the world is going to go, for sure. But there's a whole load of things we could talk about this. So Bitcoin is still very volatile. There's a load of people jumping on, say, go and buy Bitcoin, blah, blah, blah. It's $3,000 or whatever for a Bitcoin. The worst time to buy, when everybody else who doesn't understand what a cryptocurrency is talking about it. So, you know, I don't know whether you're asking generically or specifically. There are loads of digital currencies. Individuals are setting up their own currencies. This is the power of fiber optics, the power of the internet, the power of space on the web. You can set up your own social media profile, your own tech company, your own app. You can set up your own bank, as long as you're, you know, regulated, online with no overhead, with no staff. I wrote about a lady, an artist, who set up her own digital currency. And she let people buy this digital currency to buy her art. And she called it Bitchcoin, which I thought was quite cool. And you can buy Bitcoins off her and buy her work. There you go. So individuals are doing it now. And like, you know, like, there's this massive weight behind it. The banks are now interested in it. They were scared of it 10 years ago. They're all over it now. Look, when you go on your mobile app, how quick and seamless and easy it is to do. You know, you've got your Apple Pay, you flash it, and, you know, money is moving so fast. And when technology speeds up, we enter Darwinian times, i.e. survival of the fittest. Those that embrace it, they make more money than ever before. Mark Zuckerberg, youngest ever, I think, billionaire. There's a Chinese guy who had an equivalent of Amazon, and it wasn't Alibaba, but a young Chinese billionaire, like in his early 20s, with an e-commerce site. Because with an e-commerce site, you can reach millions of people, and they can pay you at the speed of light. So I'm bloody excited about all this cryptocurrency. I want a progressive currency. You're going to be buying all your courses in digital currency. Sweet. Yeah. And of course, like, air miles is a currency. So what is currency? Currency is a mechanism of exchanging money. Now, cash is slow. cash erodes. Cash gets hoarded. You know, drug dealers, they just sit on millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of cash. If a government wants some money back, they put the note out of circulation, all the drug dealers have to go and get rid of all their cash. The government will love digital currency if there's no cash, because they'll assume it's easier to tax us. They just press a button. Did you see Lord Sugar's Twitter post? He put a picture of his cheque that he paid the Inland Revenue, 58 million. Yeah, just what a statement to make. I just paid this in tax. What a brilliant statement to make. There's quite a few chapters in my new book, Money, about digital currencies. There's something else in there about increasing speed even quicker than the speed of light, but it's pretty complicated and you'd kind of need to read it. But basically, there's been simultaneous information exchange tests going on where there's been a test a few miles apart and information has been exchanged simultaneously, i.e. like a wormhole. You want to go and research this. And the way you can do that is buy my book when it comes out. So, because you can't get that, well, I was going to say you can't get that much quicker than the speed of light. I suppose if you had to go millions and millions of miles, speed of light's quite slow. But for all intents and purposes, speed of light is changing business. Like, you can get customers at the speed of light. You can solve your problems at the speed of light. You can get a million fans on a social media profile at the speed of light. You can do a live feed video, and you can go to your audience at the speed of light, or the speed of Wi-Fi, which isn't always the speed of light. So yeah, by the way, if you research digital currencies or cryptocurrencies, there's hundreds of them. Bitcoin's the one that most people know, but there's hundreds of digital currencies. The technology behind Bitcoin, blockchain, it's quite an advanced, smart technology. They're probably going to be using it for voting. They're probably going to use it in medical. So the technology behind it is pretty good.
Darren says, what's your opinion on crowdsourcing?
So when all the crowdsourcing thing came out, Mark went on every crowdsourcing site there was and tried to hack and break the system and reverse engineer it and worked out how it worked. And he applied for a loan for every single one. Just because that's what he likes to do. Like when he was a kid, when he had toys, he was taking them apart and building them back together. Because that's how his brain works. And as it has transpired, they haven't yet scaled quite to the level that I think a lot of people thought. So they haven't really replaced bank lending. They've not really disrupted bank lending like maybe we thought they would. There are a handful of crowdfunding websites which have funded some deals. But you can get better terms. You'd get better terms from friends or family. You'd get better terms from a bank. I don't know a crowdsourcing platform, you know, a regulated one, that will fund 100%. Now, if there are, I'd be surprised if they are, because it's, obviously that's risky lending that lenders don't want to do. So the alternatives are doing joint ventures, and going to individuals for private loans. So the more moving parts you put in the way of you and money, the more friction there is, therefore, the less speedy it is. And Mark just found that they'll say they'll do this, they'll say they'll do that, they say we won't want security, they'll say that the checks are quick, and then it just doesn't quite get through the system. And then, you know, the rates are competitive because they're trying to disrupt the banks, but essentially, they're loss leading to try and move money away from the banks. My friend also, who runs a competing company called Simon Zucci, he set up one. They've only raised a couple of million quid in God goodness knows how many years of doing it. So he's put a lot of work and effort and time into that. Now it might still go big for him. And of course I wish him luck. And if it's a service to our community, not just mine, but the overall property community, I hope it really succeeds. But he'll tell you, essentially you're a bank. You know, if you're setting one up. We've just not really found it that liquid. What we have found liquid is raising money off our parents, raising money off our family members, then doing loans. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what we did. Exactly. They were like, fuck off now. Yeah. Inheriting early. What? Drop her off the cliffs or something. Yeah. You won't read that and be your own bank. Yeah. I know, I'm only joking. Yeah, and hey, that was our journey. Mark and I rinsed all Mark's money. When I say we, then it was his mum, then it was my mum, then it was his stepdad, who was a bit more sceptical than his mum, then it was my uncle, And they were the ones that said yes. And you're like, I haven't been to the uncle yet. And then it was to external people. That is the way it is. Now, the way money works is it flows like water. So where there's more blockages, it's freer in other areas because it's energy and it moves. So what happened with the recession, the banking crisis, etc., is the standard place that most people went to get ninja loans, no income, no job, no assets, was banks. And then that became illiquid. But then money freed everywhere else. If banks were lending at 4%, you wouldn't need to go to your family. You wouldn't bother going to your family and just be buying, you know, using the banks. And if they were doing 90% mortgages and whatever else, they'll find ways of making it look like they're giving really favorable deals. But essentially, they have to reduce their risk. They have to cover their risk so that you'll only get the really good rates with the lower loan to values. It's kind of the way it works. So, you know, this whole money, all money out, strip all the money out thing, often Mark and I don't. We'd rather leave a small lump in if we can get 1.5% off the rate, especially in a bigger unit. You know, the difference between 2.5% and 4% on a 80,000 square foot building is huge. It's hundreds of thousands of pounds. So the upside of you not being able to get the money out of your properties is the income will be higher because it's less leveraged. So you're doing the right thing, coming to events like this, asking these questions. So I'd say whatever you've been doing to get the money you've got, keep doing it. Because people often ask me, well, where do I get money from the places you've got money before? Because, you know, people you've raised money from at some point will get more money and will have more money. And by the way, a lot of JV partners, they won't tell you how much money they've got because they don't want you to know, because they want to do one deal to see how it goes. So one assumes the JV partners you've used are dry. They're not necessarily. If you were JVing with my business partner, Mark Homer, he would never tell you how much money he's got. And he would never give it to you all up front. The two most liquid ways we found of raising money, and this is what we do pretty much all of the time now, sorry, three ways. One is we'll use our own funds if we don't want a JV partner, but we're in the fortunate position to use our own funds. So that should be an option for you. Two is loans, private loans from individuals. Family, friends, and people you meet at property, business, networking events, flying clubs, charity balls, all the things I've just said. And then three is JVs, you know, where they put the money in and you have a partnership with them. You own the, you know, obviously you've got to be careful how you pitch that so that you're within the regulations. So you probably just need to keep doing what you're doing, going to more places. You sound like you've got experience, you've raised some money before. So all of those hurdles that a lot of people who are new have got, you haven't got. You've got deals that you can show as social proof. I have a little golden rule when I go out, which is tell everyone what you do. Like, I am my 6-year-old son's biggest marketer. And whenever anyone talks to me about what I'm doing, I tell them about Bobby playing the World Championships in America, the IMG, on July the 9th, and then the US Kids World Under 6 Championships. And I go and tell everyone about him because he never tells anyone. And if I tell enough people about what he's doing, one is I might attract the right opportunities I want to come to me for, you know, whatever, sponsorship. I mean, that's how I met Justin Rose, by just telling everyone about Bobby. And then I met his sister because she bought my book. And then, I met Justin Rose. I'm there watching Justin Rose on the 17th, talking to his sister's husband, who's telling me about he's got a decent amount of money. His friend's got money. And Justin's got a load of money they want to put into property. And of course, I'm not saying anything because you've got to play it cool. You gotta play cool. If I'd have gone, Justin! But I actually don't have that outcome at the moment because I've got enough money. But there might be a time when we've got too many deals and not enough money. So, yeah, just keep getting out there and keep telling everyone what you do and money will come.
Latifa wants to know, how would you teach kids in schools about money?
Well, I think it depends on where they are in the school. You know, are they at GCSE or have they just started school? So it really depends where they are. I would just teach better money management skills. So I'd start off with operations like, you know, counting money and denominations when they're really young. Like, what's wrong at school with getting kids to count, learn to count, and giving them real money? Maybe in Peterborough, all the kids at 5 would probably nick all the money. So money management, budgeting. You know, like Mark, for example, I spend about 29% of what I earn. And that's one, because I have more spending addictions than Mark that are a legacy from when I was skinny. And two, because I've got two kids. And anyone who's got kids know that your expenses go up, and I put them in private schools and take them around the world and Bobby's golf. I was probably nearer 23%. I know my net worth statement. I know my passive and active income. You know, I know my personal balance sheet, the assets and liabilities and liquidity and what I've got in stocks and what I've got in watches and what I've got in Lego and what I've got in art. And, you know, I know all that. So budgeting, understanding money, measuring money, teaching someone what a net worth statement is, a balance sheet, a profit and loss statement is, you know, teaching them about the fundamentals of money. But of course, balance sheet, profit and loss, net worth statement, that might be a GCSE level. So how to save? You know, for example, for about 11 years, I can't remember who taught me this, but for about 11 years, I have saved every £5 note I've ever been given. And I just spread them around the place. Annoyingly, I found a few of the paper ones. Of course, they've gone out of currency now. It didn't teach me about that. Be careful in 15 years when it goes out of currency. So that's something I will pass on to Bobby. And what I do is I save it all, and then I'll put it into a very liquid but low risk investment vehicle. So you need liquidity and you need higher returns, and they're relatively inverse. So often higher return equals less liquid, lower return equals more liquid. The best liquidity is cash. It's the most liquid thing. Although something, I suppose, that travels at the speed of light could be deemed, but you know, the cash in the bank. But you get the least return on that because it doesn't have time to mature and to earn on. Of course, property is pretty illiquid. What I found with watches is Rolexes are the most liquid, and the Subs and the Daytonas, you get one of them, you can get rid of them in a week. But I've got watches that are 50 grand, 70 grand, 90 grand, 120 grand, and they're illiquid, and like I've got a Richard Mille, and they'll probably take me 2 months or 3 months to sell that. And I didn't understand that until I started buying them. So I want different levels of watches, but I've got some watches that, you know, I've got one, an AP that I paid 33 for within 6 months, it was 55. So understanding different vehicles and liquidity of money and how, so you save £5 notes, you build it up, you buy gold. You save £5 notes, you build it up, you buy gold. Then you have enough gold so that if currency devalues, gold prices will go up and you've got liquidity because the Savoy Hotel, just out, you know, the Savoy Hotel near here, but the Savoy, that you, ATS Bullion on the second floor, you just go there and you can buy Krugerrands or, you know, bullion, gold and silver, and you can sell them. And you just go in and there's a standard exchange, so it's not like you're taking a hit, like on a property, if you had to sell it quickly, you know, because you haven't got liquidity, you don't have to sell it at a low price. I save every £2 and £1 and convert it into a fiver. So I save all five. I always break 20s when I go and spend money. Spend the tenners and the 20s, save the fivers, convert the £2 and the £1 back into fivers. They all go that way. Mark's bought this massive coin counting machine, and we dump money into that every 3 months. You know, one of Mark's favourite things to do in the whole world is to go around his HMOs and empty the coin meters. He's worth millions and millions and millions, and he likes emptying the coin meters. I mean, you know, but the thing with money is once you appreciate it, you appreciate a pound as well as £1 million or £10 million. Mark has this saying, every pound is a prisoner. He treats a pound, you know, in the same way, and he doesn't take it for granted. And then with the rest of the change, I save for the kids. And I use the 50p's and the 20p's and sometimes the pounds that Bobby can win. And I use some of the 20p's and the 10p's and the 5p's and the 2p's and the 1p's to put into the kids' bank accounts. Which, by the way, all the money I put into the kids' bank accounts, and I put money in their ISAs every year. That is not to give to them. That is to them to borrow off me to do property purchases or whatever. When Bobby is world number one golfer, he will owe me 20%. I will treat him like an agent will charge him and like a manager will charge him. Because that is how money works best. I will teach him to sell from a very early age. And ultimately, you could take money away from many millionaires, but if you leave them with what they know and their ability to sell, they'll start again. And so I'll teach him to sell. I could go on and on and on and on about this. Money bucketing, so how to divide your income into different buckets. Or there's loads of sections on this in the new book. There's a whole money management section. It's probably 120 pages worth.
Ben asks the question, what were the most unexpected things you learnt when researching and writing your new book, Money?
One, that I deserved it, because I think I convinced myself that I didn't. Two, that I loved it, Because I always knew I did, but I don't think I really properly zened it. Occasionally, people will troll me for having a load of supercars. Oh, those gurus with their Ferrari. So you bring that person in the room and sitting there and get them to say publicly that they want a really shit car. You know, they really want a shit car. They've got a choice, but it doesn't matter. It could be an Aston Martin, could be one of those Mercs out there, or a fucking banger. What do you want? You ain't taking the banger. And they're not. So the thing is, it's our fear of how people react to us in society that gets us to say this bollocks. Do we want to live in a big house or a shitty little one? Well, I think we want to live in a big house. Now, maybe you want a Tesla or a Prius or a car that doesn't damage the, you know, the environment. Or maybe you want experiences and not material items. But we all want enough money to be able to do the things we love to do. And if we've got a lot of things we love to do, that takes a lot of money. So that was a kind of a second thing. And then I guess the third thing was studying enough people was that making money is a system. You know, like going from white belt to black belt in your martial arts, it's a system, it's a grading system. And you have to do certain katas and you have to do certain, you know, like I remember when I did my black belt sparring for one of my martial arts, you had to spar with the white belts first. You were sparring, the white belts come in, then the yellow belts and the orange belts, and they all come in. And by the time the brown and black belts come in, you're absolutely knackered. Then they blindfold you and you've got to spar blindfolded and all this kind of stuff. But it's just every other black belt had done it. And so it is with money. But some of that learning is unlearning all the upbringing and all the shit you've put into your head that's convinced you that making money is bad. Now, here's something else I learned about money. The first car I ever had was a really shit, rusty Vauxhall Astra. And occasionally when I used to drive it to sixth form college, my mates would take the piss. Wanker. And then I bought a Ferrari and people still used to call me a wanker. So whatever car I'm going to drive, they're going to call me a wanker. I'll have the fucking Ferrari then. And if you're going to judge me on that, judge me on that. Now, when you have a really rusty Astra, you don't get all the kids going, wow, look at that car, I love that car, you know, blah, blah, blah. But every time I used to drive the first Ferrari I had down Thorpe Road, if I weren't stalling it, all the kids outside the school, all right, mate, love the car, well, give it a rev. By the way, I had the H-gate manual, so when you give it a rev, you have to put it into neutral. I have given it a rev for the little kids at school going, what? But, and you see their little faces. And those kids are going, one day I want to grow up and have a shitty Astra. They want a Ferrari because that's their dream. And when you're skint, you're not inspiring other people. Yes, with wealth comes responsibility, and yes, you can get a bit of your head into yourself and you can have hubris and arrogance and all these kind of things. But that's not money, that's you not managing money responsibly. So in my further studies, people who can't hold on money are usually harbouring guilt. There are plenty of people who can make good money, they just can't keep it, spend it, give it away. And most charity is guilt. I'm not saying it's bad, I'm just saying it's guilt. Like if you watch all those TV shows, those adverts, to get your tenner a month, they are crowbarring guilt in you to give you the money. So when you donate, you're alleviating a pain. And that's what's happening when people have retail therapy or people are overspending on money or they're giving it away. I had a JV partner, a business partner. Any of you will know him well, but again, I don't name names. But this chap, I made him, and he was a good part of it, but I was the promoter and his partner, and I was always there pushing him, let's do more, let's do more, let's do more, let's do more. He'd have done a lot less. I made him about 5 or 6 million quid, and it's gone a lot. It's just gone. You make Mark 6 million quid, you'll see a Warren Buffett. Mark will turn 6 million quid into 200 million quid in 30 years' time. But Mark's kind of got the opposite emotion where he's got fear of everyone nicking it. So he squirrels it and he hoards it. And I have to get him to spend it some of the time. So hopefully they help.
Sam asks, is debt good or bad? And would you use debt to funnel something else?
Nothing is good or bad. So over leverage is bad. Under leverage is underutilization of capital. So the wisdom in debt is balancing the right leverage. Not enough. And you can't expand your capital base and buy assets to create passive income too much. Your overhead is more than your income. And then when things change, you're stretched or you get repossessed or whatever. So actually, like anything else, it's a balance. And that's not a cop-out answer. It's what I believe to be the truth. A good gauge of what the right debt is, as much as people don't want to admit it, the banks know what they're doing. So what the banks are lending at is about the right leverage, except when they're lending at 110%. Although you'll think that's the right thing when you go and get free mortgages. So if they're 65 to 75%, they see that as a relatively fair debt ratio. So what you generally want with debt is to create some debt that you can leverage to create income with a safe margin for error. I.e., if your rent is 550 quid, if your mortgage is 545 quid, there's no margin for error. If your mortgage is 50 quid, you can debt up a bit more. If your mortgage is 250 quid and then you've got all your costs on top, that's about right. So it's just about having that margin for error. Now, it's easy for us to look at people who see things a different way to us when we want something from them and think that they're doing it wrong. Kind of older school way, you know, never get anything on a credit card, never raise any debt. Well, if they did that slowly and sustainably over five decades, they'd be able to retire. But my guess is you want it quicker. And it was a different world back then because it was much harder to leverage back then. And 30 or 40 years ago, family members, you didn't have credit cards. It's about balancing the wisdom of risk versus reward. Thank you, everyone.